It's the Burt Cohen Show. New Year's is commonly a time of resolutions, and of course, for all of us, food often tops the list. I'm very pleased that our guest today on the Burt Cohen Show is Danielle Nierenberg, co-founder of Food Tank and author of an article, 13 Ways to Change the Food System in 2013. Well, what is Food Tank, first of all? And you say in your article about 13 ways to change the food system this year, we need a better vision for the global food system, and you call for real changes. In what ways is it broken? What changes need to be made in the food system?
Thanks for having me on the show. Food Tank is an organization that we're launching next week on January 10th, and it's a food think tank. Ellen Gustafson, my business partner, and I have really seen that there's not a lot of organizations that are really confronting food issues in a comprehensive and a strategic way and helping bridge both the international and the global, which is what we want to do with our efforts. One of the most important things that we want to do, and this was part of the 13 resolutions list that you described, is that we really want to change the metrics about how food security and nutrition are evaluated. For so long, we've simply depended on yields and the amount of calories we produce and not on environmental sustainability or the nutrients that we all need to have in our food or the how the food system can contribute to worker health and gender equity. So we want to really bring those things into the conversation. And with our 13 resolutions list, we wanted to describe some of the things that we think are important to really move food security forward and to make sure that not only are people fed, but that they're well nourished.
Well, we want to talk about what food security is. I'm hoping you can change locations a little bit. It's very echoey there. The sound quality is not great. It must be kind of echoey where you are. We were talking a little bit about food supply and making things better this year. And in the article, 13 Ways to Change the Food System, you talk about bridging disconnects. What disconnects are there? Is it between the consumer and the producer, or what disconnects are you talking about that can be improved?
This disconnect that we're referring to is on a couple of different levels. One is that consumers, eaters like you and me, we don't know where our food comes from. We don't know how it's produced, and some of that is because we don't want to. No, a lot of people don't want to know.
For sure.
How their food is produced, particularly meat production. People don't want to know what goes on in factory farms. And the other sort of disconnect is between the international agencies and foundations and other groups that are, their mission is really to help alleviate hunger and poverty. They're not talking to each other. One of the most interesting things that I discovered during a trip that I took, I spent about 2 years on the ground in Sub-Saharan Africa, Asia, and Latin America, talking to farmers and farmers groups and policymakers, public health practitioners and journalists and academics and others, collecting their thoughts about what's working on the ground. But again, one of the things that I discovered is that, the nutritionists aren't talking to the farmers and the farmers aren't talking to the food manufacturers. And all of these groups really need to come together to find ways to not only produce food, but to increase incomes and protect the environment and protect public health. And so there needs to be more collaboration between all of these groups so that that disconnect doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, that's interesting. I remember when my oldest daughter was quite young and she liked chicken. And one day she was amazed that the food called chicken, which of course comes in plastic, once actually was a bird. She was amazed at that. You know, she knew it tasted good and was fun to eat. It's like the light switch that we turn on. There's no awareness of how the power gets made, how it gets to the home. Are we more distant now from the process than in previous generations? I mean, I think about, you know, before FDR, more than half the population of America lived in rural areas. A large percentage of Americans were farmers. How is it that we've come this far, and how significant is the distance from the process than in previous generations when we kind of knew?
I think you're absolutely right. You know, we're further and further away from our food than ever before. More than half of the world's population now lives in cities, and that's something that's changed really just over the last century. Before then, you know, we were not just in the United States, but all over the world. We depended on agriculture for food and for income, and now most people again don't know where their food comes from. So. Reconnecting people to their food supply is important, and that's not only happening in rural areas, it's also happening in cities. You see this real growth in urban agriculture that's been taking place, especially since 2007 and 2008 when the food and economic crisis began. People are growing cities in places like Nairobi or Vietnam or elsewhere in the world, not because necessarily they want to, not because it's a hobby, but because they have to, because food prices are just too high for them to afford food at markets. And you know, you see here in the United States more people going to farmers markets, more people subscribing to CSAs or food subscription services, so that they can have a greater connection to their food.
What's a food subscription service? I had not heard of that.
Community-supported agriculture systems where you can, you know, at the beginning of the season in February or March, subscribe to a weekly box of food from a local farmer. And by putting that money up front, you're carrying the risk along with a farmer. You know, he or she might not have a good season, so there might not be much in that box that you get every week. But again, it gives the farmer the opportunity to really invest in his or her land, invest in producing that food, and then, you know, you are guaranteed a box every week. And again, it's just really a way for people to connect to that farmer.
Well, that's an interesting point, too. I mean, money is obviously the name of the game. That's what, you know, we go shopping for. We compare prices. You just look on the shelves. Couldn't be easier. I suppose it's a little bit more effort to buy in advance, but access to money, access to capital is a huge factor. And that's certainly one of the things that makes it difficult for small farmers is the access to capital and the giant agribusinesses, which just focus on one particular commodity. They don't seem to have the same difficulty in access to capital. I mean, in many different states, for example, it's the tax structure itself makes it difficult for farmers. I know that here where the show is coming from in New Hampshire, we rely on property taxes. And it's farmers can make a heck of a lot more money just liquidating their land, selling it to developers. Are you guys looking at that at all? I mean, the tax structure is very regressive and very, very difficult for family farms everywhere across the country. Is there any more awareness about changes needing to be made in the tax structure for family farms?
Absolutely. And it's not just the tax structure. It's every other sort of component. You know, most farmers can't get loans if they are not big farmers.
Right.
Most farmers can't get the education and resources they need if they're not big farmers. And this is something that's not only taking place in the United States, but all over the world. farmers in sub-Saharan Africa lack access to not only credit, but to land in some cases. They don't have enough money to buy land, or the land is owned by government. They don't have access to banking and financial services. This is especially problematic for women farmers. And women farmers make up to 80% of the agricultural labor force in sub-Saharan Africa. So making sure that, you know, farmers, both men and women and youth, have access to land, credit, extension services, to loans, are all things that we're going to be focusing on over the next year.
And we are talking with Danielle Nierenberg, co-founder of Food Tank, a new think tank, basically, to try to deal with the food system itself, something that we just don't really think about. And, you know, when we go to supermarkets, we feel like, you know, this is part of what's great about being an American. We get to make choices. It's up to us. But I wonder, in what ways might our choices be limited? Who and what influences our purchasing decisions? Does somebody else's choice have power over our choices?
Sure. And I mean, I think going into a grocery store, you look around you and you're sort of overwhelmed by the choices. But if you dig a little deeper into the products that are in most grocery stores, they're you know, the main ingredients of all of those packaged products you've seen are corn and soybeans and rice and wheat. So the choice and the variety is really an illusion, because you're looking at a lot of processed foods that are based on the same commodity crops. These are crops that are grown in monoculture systems. They don't contribute to agricultural biodiversity. And the farmers who are growing them, whether they're in China, Brazil, or the United States, don't make a lot of money growing them. So it's kind of the whole system is a myth, the myth that, you know, we're growing enough variety to fill people's needs. You know, one of the other myths that we really want to confront is that the idea that we need to keep increasing yields and increasing how many calories we produce. Right now, the world produces more than enough food, about twice as much food, to feed every man, woman, and child on Earth today. And at the same time, we're wasting vast amounts of food. About 1.3 billion tons of food is wasted each year. About 40% of that food is wasted in the developing world, where people, farmers and processors and other folks involved in the food system don't have proper transportation, so they can't get their food to market. They don't have adequate storage facilities so that their crops get destroyed by pests or mold. And they don't often have the markets to sell their food, so food just goes to waste, even though people, particularly in places like sub-Saharan Africa, are very hungry. So really, dispelling these myths, you know, making sure that there are proper policies and procedures in place to make sure that food doesn't get wasted. In the United States, for example, we waste about 30% of all the food we buy, and that's because food is cheap. We don't value it as much as we should, and if we valued it more, we'd be more likely to eat it or use it and not throw it away where it ends up in a landfill. And this is not only a moral conundrum. It's also an environmental problem.
Yes.
Food waste in the United States contributes to greenhouse gas emissions because that food rots in landfills and it's methane. So really looking at this from all angles is important.
And that actually is number 7 on your list of 13. And let's deal with that one and then perhaps just go through the list. The waste, it always bugged me. You know, you go in a restaurant and they just seem to throw out a bunch of food that's not eaten. And you're right. If it goes bad, you think nothing of it for most people. I wonder about, you know, composting. I personally try to compost virtually all food waste, if at all possible. Is there a real change in terms of composting? Is it coming to institutional eateries like restaurants and schools? Are there economical opportunities for preserving food that now goes to waste?
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, in places like the Gambia and Bolivia, farmers are finding ways to preserve abundant harvests of mangoes, for example. The mango season tends to be very short. You get a ton of mangoes at one time, and you can't eat them all. So they're using solar-powered dehydrators and dryers to preserve those mangoes. And it's not only an important source of vitamin A for consumers, but it's also a source of income for farmers because they have a value-added product to sell throughout the year. And for composting, this is something that's really taken off over the last 5 or 10 years in the United States. Everything from very she restaurants in New York City to universities and colleges are composting food waste and then using it to grow vegetables at university farms and gardens on rooftops in places like New York City. So it can, turning that waste into a really valuable source of fertilizer is important. But on the other end, we really need to start thinking about ways to prevent food waste before it happens. Again, you and I usually, especially around the holidays, cook and buy too much food and it goes to waste. And so sort of rethinking proportions and figuring out how much to cook. And there are a couple of different organizations around the world who are teaching consumers how much to buy, how much to cook, teaching them about expiration dates so that they don't throw away food before it's actually gone bad. So those are all really important things that, you and I can do in our homes. And then on an international level, the funding and donor communities, these are the groups that invest in agriculture, particularly in developing countries, they need to start investing more in infrastructure, whether it's better roads so farmers can get their produce to market, better storage facilities, and better sort of access all along the food chain so farmers can get the things that they worked so hard to produce and used a lot of their own labor and resources to produce, so that those things that they can get them to market and make money off of them. Because as you mentioned before, money is sort of the name of the game here. If farmers aren't making money, all of these innovations that we're talking about will really all be for naught.
And one thing that has worked pretty well to prevent waste so far in the past has been living better through chemistry. Preservatives, what the heck? Why not just sprinkle some kind of chemical preservatives on everything? That way we cut down on waste. I get the sense, quite frankly, that a lot of people care more about preservatives and are tuning a bit away from that. What can you say about chemical preservatives?
I mean, we have been able to have, instituted all these sort of amazing technologies, whether it's refrigeration or fungicides or preservatives to help preserve food. And I think, as consumers, especially in the industrialized world, that when they seek more natural foods or more whole foods, they're turning away from these preservatives. And it's not to say that all processed foods are bad or all preservatives are bad, but we also need to really, focus on making sure that healthy, fresh, and nutritious foods are available to people as well, especially the folks like you and me who don't want a lot of chemicals in our food.
Yeah, we don't, but they can preserve them at some point, but what it's doing to our bodies, there does seem to be a great increase in the awareness about that. Danielle Nirenberg of Food Tank, you talked a little bit earlier just about in stopping waste with growing in cities, using composting in cities, composting on roofs and things like that. That's actually the point number one. Why should we be more aware of this aspect of agriculture growing in cities? Our farmers, when you go to a city, farmers markets always seem to be pretty popular. Can hydroponics become a bigger part of the mix? What about growing in cities and what we should be aware of with regard to agriculture?
Well, one of the biggest is, more and more people are moving to cities. About half of the world's population now lives in urban areas. And so finding ways to cut transportation costs of transporting food from rural areas to cities will be important, especially as fossil fuel prices rise. Again, really connecting people to where their food comes from. urban kids can participate in community gardens, and schools can have gardens on their rooftops. Chefs are increasingly interested in urban agriculture because they can have more control over what they're cooking and selling in their restaurants. They can know how it's grown, and a lot of restaurants are growing more food, you know, either in their backyards or on their rooftops to really reduce the distance between where the food is grown and where it comes from. And I think, again, this is something that's only going to increase as urban populations continue to rise. The United Nations estimates that about 1 billion people are farming in cities all over the world, and that's everywhere from Chicago, Illinois, to where I live, to Dakar, Senegal, and to places like Beijing, Rio, and other big cities around the world. So it's only something that's going to continue to grow. Unfortunately, there are a lot of barriers to farming in cities. Often zoning laws prevent people from raising bees, for example, in cities because of public health concerns. Or in places like Nairobi, farmers are not encouraged to raise livestock like goats in the city because of policies that are focused on modernizing agriculture. So really helping remove those barriers, make urban agriculture something that's safe for farmers to do and for consumers to eat is really, really important.
You bring up a question of modernizing. You know, maybe we're starting to rethink the whole concept of what modernizing is. I remember back in the 60s, there was urban development, which destroyed whole neighborhoods, and that was a big oops. And so perhaps the what we think of as modernizing maybe needs to change a little bit. You know, I have to say, oh, go ahead. You were about to say something.
No, I completely agree. I think in a lot of ways we can go forward by going back to some of the more traditional and sustainable farming practices that, you know, farmers used for centuries. And I think there's also a huge opportunity. You know, you don't want to turn away from technology completely.
Right.
I think there's a real opportunity that we're not taking here to combine both high and low technologies.
Interesting. Well, we can do that. And you know, yield is one thing that's been a drive for a long time. It's just been kind of assumed that it's a positive good to increase yields. And one way to do that, of course, is something that the company Monsanto, yes, boo hiss, can claim credit for. They've talked about being how helpful they are in increasing yield through their genetically modified organisms. And they say, well, they're helping to feed poor people to get them access to more food. But what about this genetically modified organisms? Is that something that's actually good, that we're just, you know, Luddites who are afraid of genetically modified organisms? Can that be something that is a good technology?
I think the thing about genetically modified organisms and transgenics and the whole other suite of biotechnology technologies is that, you know, exactly what you said, a lot of them haven't lived up to their promises. The yields that were, the higher yields that were promised haven't really come through. And there have been several studies now that show that conventional and or organic yields are either comparable to the yield from biotech agriculture, or in some cases even higher. So the fact that we're in some ways forcing farmers, particularly in the developing world, to buy GMO seeds and to use GMO inputs, you know, the inputs necessary to grow these crops, when they could be getting the same or higher yields from conventional or organic or sustainable agriculture, seems a little confusing, because if the whole point is raising yields and increasing incomes, I haven't seen GMO crops doing that. That doesn't mean that they don't have potential, but they've been in production for more than 20 years now. The research has been going on for a long time, and I think, you know, in a lot of ways, our resources, that funding and investment that, you know, is very scarce, even though a lot more funders and donors are interested in agriculture now, I think to get more bang for our buck, we should be investing in things that we already know work.
That's true, and GMOs are clearly damaging to many other crops, the way the seeds spread. They're very questionable when it comes to increasing yield of milk, how that affects young girls in particular that take it in. It's kind of, I think, an agreed upon yuck, stay the heck away from genetically modified organisms. We're talking to Danielle Nierenberg, co-founder of Food Tank, about 13 ways to change the food system in 2013. We haven't gotten through many of the 13 so far, but the second point is creating better access. That's very, it's a bigger problem than I think a lot of people think about. I mean, nobody thinks about getting food from point A to point B. Oftentimes it creates a lot of carbon, a very heavy carbon footprint to go from one place to another, having to freeze the food the entire way. And, you know, supermarkets, let's face it, they often operate with a very small profit margin. I wonder about somehow enabling better access for people with less money, poor people, if it can be accomplished. Can poor people get better access within our current profit-driven food system, or is that too difficult to accomplish?
I think the problem is that a lot of food retailers haven't wanted to enter urban areas, low-income urban areas, right, whether, you know, they're in South Africa or the United States. Farmers haven't seen those as, or I'm sorry, producers haven't seen those as places where they want to, you know, have their businesses set up. And so poor people are forced to buy from convenience stores or gas stations even. And these are places that don't provide a lot of healthy food. You see a lot of processed foods. You see a lot of high fat, high salt, high calorie snacks available, and not much in the way of fresh produce. So helping, you know, fertilize and water these food deserts, these places that don't have access to fresh food is very important. And you know, mobile grocery stores are increasing in cities all over the country, whether in San Francisco or Chicago, and really bringing fresh, organic food to consumers who otherwise wouldn't have access to them.
Interesting. Access, how it can be done economically, how we can have it fresh. And your third point of the 13 points is, you quote food writer Michael Pollan, "Don't eat anything your grandparents wouldn't recognize." Now, it seems to me a lot of what we eat today, our grandparents would have no clue as to what it is. I mean, it's easier said than done. And, you know, you look at what's healthy, organic, locally grown food, it tends to be more expensive. Does there have to be, as you were touching on before, a two-tiered food system? Or does healthy food have to just be available only to people who have money?
Absolutely not. And groups like Fresh Moves in Chicago, one of the groups I mentioned that's a mobile grocery unit, they're providing food that they grow in the city at reasonable prices to poorer or low-income consumers. And this is something that can be replicated in cities all over the country and even the world. Fresh, healthy, sustainable food, it should be a human right. It shouldn't be based on how much income you have. It should be based on all of us being part of the human family, and we all deserve access to safe and healthy food.
I would think we do. I would think that is a right, actually, and not just a privilege, but I suppose some people on the right might disagree with that, like health being a privilege, not a right. But I would tend to think that especially here in the midst of the 21st century, it really should be right. Your fourth point, I think, is interesting. Cooking more. These days, what kids seem to know about cooking seems to be limited to taking up something out of the fridge or the freezer, popping it in the microwave. And for working adults, the pace for people in the Western world has continuously accelerated in recent decades. Is cooking more actually, is it really an option? And I wonder if in answering that, you can talk about comparing the costs of home cooking to eating out and fast food.
I mean, I think there's a myth that you know, getting food from a fast food restaurant is cheaper than cooking at home. I think because consumers have forgotten how to cook, that they're so stuck on using microwaves and you know, just shoving a box in there, that they've forgotten that, you know, there's a lot of low-cost ways to use lentils and beans and low-fat sources of dairy products and other foods to really nourish their families. And that these are things that don't have to take a long time. I think because people don't cook every day anymore and they only cook around the holidays, that they think it always has to be this very time-intensive thing.
Yes.
But it can actually be a way to, you know, bring your family into the kitchen and create more conviviality and sharing of food with not only your family members, but your neighbors and other folks in the community. And I think we've forgotten that food is not just fuel. It's a way to bring all of us together. We all have to eat. And so sharing food and making meal times a way to connect with other people is going to be really important. And again, you know, as food prices and fuel prices, as petroleum prices rise,
yes,
over the next few years, we're going to need to focus more on local and regional sources of food and really finding ways to connect with one another.
Yeah, connecting and being part of a community. It seems like now that we can be so isolated and individualized because it is still economical, there's not as much motivation to do that. I wonder, is there, I mean, I certainly tend to think, I mean, I like lentils and stuff like that, but my impression is it takes a hell of a lot longer to cook. Are there sources to which you can point listeners to find out how to cook healthy food when, you know, everybody's in such a rush all the time?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the best places to start, and this is a place where my mom used to go for cooking advice or gardening advice, is USDA Extension Services. We've forgotten you know, all of us pay for extension services through our taxes, you know, to the USDA through for them to provide us information about gardening or cooking or other sources. And then there's so many healthy eating blogs and websites that consumers can go to find more information. All you have to do is Google healthy eating, and websites like Epicurean will come up, and Cooking Light, and other magazines and organizations that are really helping encourage consumers not only how to eat more healthy, but how to do it quickly.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and you know, having the web is a fantastic tool, so it can take a little bit of time just to look that up and save a heck of a lot of time and be more healthy. And the fifth point, you know, you already mentioned that a little bit, creating conviviality. You know, I'm old enough to remember when there was always a family dinner virtually every night. I wonder how this has changed and how many people now eat alone. In fact, you know, I certainly have been known to eat in front of my computer and try not to get the food on the keyboard. But, you know, this is part of American society. How important is, as you say, creating conviviality, how important is this to family and to kids in particular?
Well, I mean, you know, the recent surveys show that about half of American adults eat alone every day.
Wow.
And, you know, this is disturbing to me as someone who really is focused on food and sustainability. But you're right, I often end up eating in front of my computer because of time. But the more that we can create conversation and foster community around food, the better, and especially for youth and for young children. I remember mealtimes giving me a real structure to my day, and I knew I had to be home for dinner every night, and I knew that's when I would have the opportunity to chat with my parents or ask them questions or do whatever else that family should be doing that we're just not doing anymore.
Yeah, it's really important for sure to do that, if at all possible. And, you know, grown-ups always talk about kids these days. Well, it's parents not necessarily making time to do that. And speaking of kids, it seems to me that, of course, kids these days, ancient expression, kids these days, get away with eating fewer vegetables and fruit. And that is your sixth point, this focus on vegetables. Is this starting to change? And I wonder about the societal and individual effect of kids and adults not eating enough veggies.
It's a really important question. You know, around the world, about 2 billion people suffer from micronutrient deficiencies. These are things like vitamin A or iodine. And part of this deficiency is a result of focusing on commodity crops and increasing uh-huh. yields of those things like maize and soy and wheat and rice, and not really focusing on the things that make those commodity crops, those staple crops, taste good. It's the sauces that are made out of vegetables, or the side portions of meals that make, you know, meat and staple crops taste good. And unfortunately, there's not a lot of investment, again, from the funding and donor communities in increasing vegetable production. But making sure that poor and wealthy consumers alike have more access to vegetables, that they are encouraged to eat them, that they know how to cook them so that they taste good and that they're not overcooked, are going to be really important things to make sure that, again, not just that people are fed, but that they're well nourished.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and it's not junk food, literally junk food. Of course, kids like junk food, but it is called junk food for a reason. And I'm guessing the information about vegetables can also be found at the USDA, the Department of Agriculture. I bet they have a lot of information there. Probably. And you touched on engaging youth a little bit. And I have to tell you, after I got my degree in European history, I drove an apple truck, put my degree to work. But I'll tell you, working in agriculture on a farm was tremendously enriching. People I know in agriculture now value it tremendously. And I wonder how we can make farming more appealing to youth. And is that important to make farming more appealing to youth, both here in America and abroad?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the average age of farmers is around 57 years old. Uh-huh. And that's something that's true both, you know, in Iowa or sub-Saharan Africa. Our farming population is really aging. And it's for a couple of different reasons. One, you know, that population migration that I mentioned before, more and more people are moving to cities.
Yes.
Because that's where they think the jobs and opportunity are. But, you know, often youth from rural areas get to cities and the jobs are low paid, they're living in slums, you know, they're not making a good living. And so really finding ways to make agriculture something that's both economically and intellectually stimulating will help keep kids on the farm because they see real opportunity there. They see that they can make money that is interesting to them. And two, you know, major advances over the last 10 years have really helped spur this effort to keep kids on farms. And one is the internet, and the other is the expansion of cell phones. You know, I spent a lot of time in sub-Saharan Africa, and nearly every person you talk to, no matter how poor they are, either has their own cell phone or access to a cell phone. And they're using these phones not just to talk to one another, but also to get information about weather and climate so that they can predict what crops to grow that year. They're getting financial and banking information on their phone so that they can work with suppliers to get paid through mobile technologies that allow payments through their cell phones. They're getting banking and loan information through their cell phones. So this has really revolutionized farming, and I think it's something that will continue to really help engage youth and keep them in rural communities because, again, they see this real vibrant opportunity there.
Well, I can see that in international, in developing countries, but I don't know about here in America. I mean, it's certainly the romance of family farming is real. I mean, there are certainly benefits from it, but I don't know about encouraging people, young people, to go into farming. It seems to be, I don't know, sort of dying out. I don't know how you can make that more.
I would completely disagree. If you
Good.
Look at the young farmer movement in this country, it's one of the most vibrant and exciting parts of the economy. You see kids
Good
who
to hear.
Have gone to places like Cornell or Harvard, and instead of becoming bankers or financial analysts, they're going into the food system, not just as producers or farmers, but also as chefs and entrepreneurs. A lot of people are opening, you know, sustainable butcher shops. They're making artisanal breads and pickles and all of these other things that you and I have a real craving for because we want to connect to a food system that is not full of processed foods, but full of food that people actually made by hand and put a lot of work and love into. So I think, you know, groups like Food Corps, which is an organization working through AmeriCorps to really engage, people just out of college in the food system by sending them to both rural and urban areas to start school gardens and teach kids how to cook and really help curb the obesity epidemic. So there are a million organizations doing more work, and I'm really very inspired by the vibrance of the youth and agriculture community, especially in the United States.
Well, that is very great to hear. It is really good to hear. We're talking on the Bert Cohen Show with Danielle Nierenberg, co-founder of Food Tank, author of an article, 13 Ways to Change the Food System in 2013. Some very good, encouraging news there. And your ninth point is protecting workers. It seems to me that throughout the 20th century, the struggle by farm workers for decent working conditions and pay has been fought over and over and over again. It seems that what's become normal is migrant workers who are exploited, have lousy working conditions, lousy pay, get exposed to all kinds of chemicals. I wonder if you could speak to this point, how we can protect workers better.
I mean, agriculture is one of the professions with the highest injury rate in the United States. Workers in slaughterhouses have the highest turnover rate in the United States because it's not only an unsightly job, it's very dangerous. And so making sure that farmer laborers are protected all along the food system is very important. We don't have a lot of laws in place that protect especially undocumented workers or recent immigrants. They're paid very low wages because, a lot of folks don't want those jobs. The food system is really built on the back of these laborers who are paid very low wages, who often don't have access to sanitation facilities while they're working, who don't have access to insurance. They're making very low wages. But groups like the Immokalee workers, the Coalition of Immokalee Workers in Florida, are really bringing together tomato pickers. These are folks who work up and down the East Coast to pick tomatoes for all of the big companies, including Kroger and Trader Joe's and Chipotle. And, they've been fighting for many years just to get one more penny per pound for the tomatoes that they're growing. And this doesn't seem like a lot, but if you're picking, 50 pounds of tomatoes, before lunch every day, it all adds up. And for a long time, these big retailers and fast food chains were dismissing the Immokalee workers, but they've made real strides, especially over the last 5 years, to encourage companies to become part of their coalition and join and promise better pay for workers.
And that just is yet another example of people power making a difference. When people speak up, it really absolutely makes a difference. The markets do react to public pressure. It works. I mean, you have more milk now being labeled no GMOs used in the process because the people demanded it. It can make a difference. And I must say, it's nice to see some of the old 60s hippie values making it in terms of healthy food, being together and caring about workers out there. We seem to be winning that cultural war. And, culture, pretty much at least part of culture, can always be measured in part by its how it distributes food, how it gets to food. And farmers generally, it seems like throughout most of the 20th century, at least that later part of the 20th century, farmers weren't always culturally and politically valued. And this is point number 10 in your list of 13, acknowledging the importance of farmers. How can we do this and improve the recognition of the value of farmers?
I think it's really important to recognize their multiple roles. These are folks who not only, put seeds in the ground, but they're businesswomen and businessmen.
Yes.
They're stewards of the land. They're protecting the environment. They're teachers teaching other people in their community how to do different sustainable practices. And I think, you know, again, with the growth of the food movement, you see a real recognition that farmers aren't stupid people. They're not working the land because they can't do anything else. They're working the land because they're tied to it. They value it. They believe in it. And really valuing that profession is something that, you know, again, youth want to aspire to, or that other people want to get involved in, I think is really important. And you know, just how we don't value teachers in the United States, we don't right. value our farmers, and that really needs to change.
Yeah, it certainly does. And certainly farmers have been pushed out, again, because of high taxes. As I mentioned earlier, they can make a lot more money, oftentimes, hell of a lot more, by just selling the land for development. We need to look at new crops that can be raised and changing crops and not being dependent on certain crops. And which brings up point number 11 in the list of 13, recognizing the role of governments. As you say in the article, nations must implement policies that give everyone access to safe, affordable, healthy food. Well, that's very political. I wonder about what governments can do in terms of making access to safe and affordable, healthy food actually a right and not just a privilege. This is a big one, changing the political conversation about this.
Absolutely, and I think the biggest thing that nations can do is sign on to the UN Declaration on the Right to Food and really guarantee that food is not just, you know, something for the wealthy. It's something for all of us, and it is a human right. You know, you see countries in sub-Saharan Africa, for example, only about 9 countries in sub-Saharan Africa devote 10% or more of their budget to agriculture. And these are economies that are agriculture-based. And so they're neglecting to invest in small-scale and medium-scale agriculture in their own countries. That really needs to change. You need more investment so that small-scale and medium-scale farmers alike have the opportunity to not only grow food, but raise income, you know, and help protect the environment. If we're not investing in farmers, we're really we're doing so at our own peril.
Do you see movement along these lines in Congress? I mean, you talk about dysfunctional. My goodness, Congress has been just absurd lately. But there are certainly members of Congress who seem to be basically lobbyists for agribusiness in their states. But what about, on to the next point, changing the metrics? What can be done about, increasing respect for family farmers, making tax burdens more fair for farmers? Is there movement in the U.S. government now to address the issues that we're talking about here?
There hasn't been a lot of movement, and that's for a couple of different reasons. One, you know, a lot of the folks in Congress get financial support from the big food lobbies, whether it's the cattlemen or the big dairy lobbies or the soy and maize lobbies. You know, we're not seeing a lot of progress because these folks are not only working for us, they're working for some of these big companies. So the more that we can have, you know, campaign finance reform, the more we can have those sorts of things implemented, I think the better off we'll all be. You know, Congress won't be making, you know, Congress people won't be making as much money, but well, I think we'll all be better off.
Yeah, virtually every issue we talk about on the Bert Cohen Show somehow relates to the need for campaign finance reform. But we're talking about food here. We're talking about 13 ways to change the food system in 2013. The final point on the list of 13 is fixing the broken food system. You know, and we have massive unemployment now. That's a big problem. We have climate change. That's a big problem. We have much more obesity than we've ever had before. That's a big problem. I wonder if addressing food production and distribution concerns will actually help address these problems as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think agriculture has a big potential to be the solution to some of our most pressing environmental and social challenges. That's everything from decreasing unemployment to decreasing the obesity epidemic to making sure that the environmental sustainability of our food system is better, to really making us all better able to share meals and to talk to one another over food and about food. I think we have a real opportunity here. And especially with climate change, you know, agriculture is often blamed for contributing to greenhouse gas emissions, but it's also the human endeavor most likely to be affected by changes in climate.
True.
And there are lots of opportunities for agriculture to contribute to climate change mitigation and adaptation. In sub-Saharan Africa alone, farmers could sequester 50 billion tons of carbon over the next 50 years simply by planting more trees among crops, that's using agroforestry methods, stewarding nearby forests, and keeping their crop their land planted with crops for more of the year, things like cover crops. So there's a real opportunity for agriculture to be at the center of solutions to all of these problems.
Fascinating. And we have something like 7 billion human beings on this planet now. Isn't population control part of the solution? Don't we have to do something about that? I mean, I can't, trying to feed decently 7 billion people. Yikes.
I think you're right on one level. I think we need to really address the elephant in the room, and that's, you know, the growing world population. We're expecting 9 billion people by 2050 and 12 billion people by the end of the century. And so really helping make access to reproductive health services will be increasingly important, so that women and families can choose how many children they want to have. You know, population control is sort of outdated. What we really want to focus on now is providing the resources, especially for women, that they're lacking right now. Women lack, a voice in not only their households, but often in their communities. So increasing women's status will be increasingly important. And again, making sure that families have the opportunity to choose how many children they want to have.
Yes. And perhaps we can even, dare I say, democratize the food system, have, you know, the ability to choose be not just from among corporate created products in the store, but actually bringing more democracy to it. What do you think about that?
Absolutely. The issue of food sovereignty, the idea that food needs to be democratized, that we all can have a say in where our food is produced, how it is produced, and how much it costs, will be very important, especially over the next 10, 15, 20 years as climate change takes a bigger hold on the world. And we, you know, some farmers in different regions will be growing more food. Other farmers in other regions of the world will be growing less food as a result of climate change. So really democratizing the food system is very important.
Fascinating stuff. Let me get the website directly to listeners. What is it? You tell us what it is, Danielle.
It's www.foodtank.org. That's FOODTANK.org.
So a think tank for food, changing the food system. Fascinating stuff as we move forward well into the 21st century. Danielle Nirenberg, co-founder of Food Tank. And thank you so much for being with us, and best of luck in the future. Getting people back to the farms is definitely a good thing to do. Thank you, Danielle.
Thank you. Bye.
All right. Bye. The Farm. Jefferson Airplane.
Come is my next door neighbor coming down the road. He always looks so regal, riding on his toad little Lightning. The toad's name is Lightning, his head hangs at the shoulder, and if you give him sugar, you know, whinny like a boulder. Yes, he will. Yes, it's good living on the farm. Oh, so good.
The Jefferson Airplane, The Farm, augmented by the late, great Nicky Hopkins on piano.